Good morning, Oregon, and thank you once again for loading me down and queuing me up. I'm Finn J.D. John, bringing you another daily episode of the Offbeat Oregon History Audio Edition podcast, which every weekday brings you another story from the archives of the Offbeat Oregon History syndicated newspaper column. Full details are at offbeatoregon.com. Do check that out. But first, sit back and relax and let me tell you the story of the Blimp Squadron that was the first line of defense against attack upon the North American continent by the Axis enemy during World War II. I'm talking about these massive dirigibles, Goodyear blimps, basically, that were housed in the largest clear span wood buildings in the world. There were a bunch of them, you know, all over the country, but one of them, well, two of them were near Tillamook. One of them caught fire in 1992, but the other one's there today. It houses the Tillamook Air Museum. So this story was first published on May 21st, 2011. I'm going to read it to you now. Just south of Tillamook, tucked into a deep green valley surrounded by dairy farms, is the largest clear span wood frame building in the world. This is the Tillamook Naval Air Station Dirigible Hangar B, whipped together in just a few months during the early years of World War II. Its world's largest title is one that it shares with several other dirigible hangars built on the same plans in other parts of the country at the same time. But the hangar in Tillamook is the only one of these that's currently open to the public. These hangars have a 7-acre footprint. They're 296 feet wide, 1,050 feet long, big enough for 3 football fields with bleachers on each side. There's about 2.5 million board feet of gorgeous, clear, old-growth Douglas fir in each one of them. Tillamook Hangar B was home to a squadron of 8 military blimps. The conventional wisdom is that these blimps arrived on the scene too late to have a real impact on the war, that by the time they were regularly patrolling the West Coast in late 1943, the threat of Japanese attacks had passed. But that isn't entirely true. In fact, we'll probably never really know the full extent to which the Oregon-based blimp fleet prevented attacks on the West Coast, but it's a good bet that if they'd been suddenly grounded in, say, the summer of 1944, we would have noticed, and some people might actually have been killed. Here's the story. During the years just before World War II, the U.S. was getting increasingly nervous about Nazi and Imperial Japanese submarine fleets. It was hard to imagine a bunch of surface warships skulking unnoticed across the Atlantic Ocean to attack the U.S., but a submarine could do just that, and lurk there, waiting for prey to steam by for months on end. As a matter of fact, early in the war, one did just that. That would be the I-25. Well, regular airplanes were okay against subs, but they couldn't stay in the air for very long, and they didn't have the ability to hover over a convoy all day. Blimps, though, blimps were perfect. Their main drawback was that they were huge and easy for aircraft to shoot down. But for defending shipping near the U.S. mainland, enemy aircraft were not a problem. So the Navy got started building a network of 17 massive blimp hangars at strategic and sheltered locations around the coastline. To cover the area of the West Coast from Seattle down to Northern California, the Navy built 2 of these massive hangars at Tillamook. The airships they put in them were Goodyear K-class soft-sided blimps, 216 feet long, filled with helium rather than hydrogen. I should point out that there were soft-sided blimps and there were hard-sided blimps. The hard-sided were kind of like the Hindenburg, the German one that exploded before World War II. These were soft-siders. They moved at a maximum speed of roughly 70 miles per hour, had a range of 2,000 miles, and could float around for up to 3 days, looking straight down into the sea in search of the shadowy outline of a submarine. If they found one, they had 4 depth charge bombs on board with which to do something about it, and of course the ability to contact other Navy assets, bombers, warships, etc., as well. They also carried a pair of 50 caliber machine guns. Off the East Coast, protecting convoys against Nazi subs, the blimps had a substantial effect. Although they sank few, if any, U-boats, the presence of a blimp over a convoy was usually enough to prevent an attack on it. A submarine at torpedo depth was easy to spot, especially on a sunny day, and nothing wrecks a gunner's concentration like a well-placed depth charge. But the West Coast was only visited by 10 Japanese submarines, most of them early in the war, before the squadron was up to speed. By the time blimp patrols were happening regularly, Japan had pulled its subs back to help defend its other naval assets from an increasingly overwhelming American Pacific fleet. So in the West, the conventional wisdom had for a long time has been that the blimps just flew patrols, looking for something that wasn't there but might arrive at any time for the remainder of the war. But it turns out they did other things as well. Japan had this desperate plan, you see, late in the war to light the forests of Oregon and Washington on fire. To do this, they launched unmanned balloons with incendiary bombs on the prevailing winds to be carried across the sea. After the amount of time they calculated it would take them to drift across the Pacific Ocean, the balloons would deflate, fall to the ground, and the bombs would explode, torching the surrounding forest. If a bomb fell in a West Coast town, so much the better, as the casualties and the fear of future attacks would undermine American morale, or so the theory went. And by the way, there is a link to an excellent and thorough account of the balloon bomb program, in particular the role played by American geologists in identifying the exact part of Japan from which the bombs came so that the B-29s could strike back, published by Professor J. David Rogers of Missouri University of Science and Technology. And you can access that through a link on the webpage for this story, which you can find by going to offbeatoregon.com and clicking on the 2011 link. You'll find it about halfway down the list. It was published late in May. Also, did you know that one of these bombs is suspected of having started the 1945 Tillamook burn? More information is also accessible from the same webpage in the form of an Offbeat Oregon article. Back to our story. The Japanese launched about 10,000 of these balloons in late 1944 and early 1945. About 300 of them reportedly made it through. Fighter planes were helpful, but the balloons rode the air currents very high up, at around 35,000 feet, more than 6 miles. Getting an airplane off the ground and up that high in the air could take as long as an hour and burn plenty of fuel, leaving little time to fly around looking for bombs before having to turn around and go back down to the airfield. Well, enter the blimp fleet. We'll probably never know how many balloons blimps knocked out of the sky with their machine guns. The U.S. government was keeping a lid on the whole thing, hoping that the lack of hubbub would convince the Japanese that their balloon program wasn't working, a strategy that, as it turns out, worked nicely. But we do know that at least one blimp operating out of Tillamook was assigned to search out and intercept these balloons. So the squadron at Tillamook may not have seen much action against submarines, but it's possible that they saved the U.S. from something even more dangerous. Well, at the end of the war, the Navy was a lot less worried about having to defend the U.S. mainland, which is all the blimps were really useful for. In 1948, the Navy decided to close the Tillamook station down. The county leased and later bought the place to run as an airport. The hangars were used for a variety of things, civilian blimp tours, a lumber mill, balloon testing, even aircraft manufacturing. A massive fire demolished one of the Tillamook blimp hangars in 1992. Someone made the, in retrospect, remarkably short-sighted decision to rent it to a farmer who wanted to store hay in it. Anyone who has lived in an agrarian area that produces hay knows those big, giant hay barns are famous for this sort of thing. Today, the surviving hangar is home of the Tillamook Air Museum, which features a huge collection of vintage aircraft and memorabilia, and is well worth a visit. That's it for today's episode. And if you're listening for the first time and want some more information about Offbeat Oregon history, you can get it all at our central website, offbeatoregon.com. That's the complete catalog of about 205 columns going back to 2008, plus links out to audio and text feeds on RSS and iTunes, and to the Facebook page and Twitter feed in case you'd like to join the conversation. The website's also where you'll find full citations to sources for this story, which for today's episode include the Naval Air Tillamook Historical Society, the Naval Airship Association, the Tillamook Air Museum, and the U.S. National Park Service. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band, atlasstringband.com, written by Carmen Ficarra. This podcast is covered under a Creative Commons license. For details of that, see offbeatoregon.com/cc. If you're coming to Corvallis, please do drop me a line. I'd love to get together and have a cup of coffee and talk history. I'm at finn@offbeatoregon.com. Tomorrow morning, we'll have an episode from long, long ago in 2009, talking about the Spanish flu epidemic that slammed the entire nation and Oregon as well in 1918. So look for that after about 6 a.m. tomorrow morning. That would be Christmas Eve. In the meantime, go out and fill up the rest of today with good stuff. Bye now.